Welcome once again to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides. We're part of the Pantheon group of podcasts, and I have to say, I'm enjoying the weekly journey. Great fun, and easy to put together if I be truthful enough. Ian Wilson was on the podcast a month and a half ago, sharing stories about his time as an agent, managing as the alarm and stuff. And he told us about a story about being U2's first agent, booking them their first gigs, kind of 8 gigs in 10 days in London, I think, but it'll tell you in a minute, and before they even have a record contract. But we shall leave it to Mr. Wilson.
I didn't give up because James Todd, who was no longer really interested in seeing bands himself, and his face was buried in the NME looking at adverts for the photos, had a brother, Tim. And his brother, Tim, worked for Ariola Hansa Publishing. Ariola Hansa eventually bought didn't they merge with BMG, I think, and ended up owning RCA. But in those days, it was Ariola. And Tim, as a publisher, got all the demos of all the acts in the whole of the UK and Ireland coming across his desk. And he got this one demo from this act called U2. And he came into our office and he was saying, "You've got to listen to this. It's really good." So he put it on. James didn't lift his head from the NME. But I said to Tim, "I like that. That guy can play guitar." I could immediately hear that there was a guitar player on that. That was like seeing Knopfler. You knew. It was like seeing Andy Summers. You knew. It wasn't punk. They were players. And also the track that I remember, it was a track called Boy Girl. It was off the demo was actually a 12-inch piece of vinyl called U2-3, which was to be released in Ireland or had just been released in Ireland. And the other track was called Out of Control. And they had a vocal harmonizing, which I'd been a choir boy myself back in the day. And I recognized that harmony that they had as being almost like choristers, and the sort of musician in me could hear that they were really good. And I said to James, "That's great. I think we should be going after this band." And he said, "All right, let's put them on with Squeeze," he said, because the photos were on with Squeeze by now, but the photos had to record a single that weekend. So they were not going to go to Ireland where Squeeze were playing. So there was an opening on a Sunday night in Belfast. So James picked up the phone to Paul McGuinness and introduced himself and said that would they like to play on that show with Squeeze in Belfast, and that someone from the office would be coming over to see them. And that someone was me. I went with Bob because Bob was the agent for Squeeze. It's the first time I'd ever taken an aeroplane flight. And of course, when I got to Heathrow, Bob didn't show. He was late. So I decided I'd get the plane. So I got the plane, first time on a plane, flew to Belfast, had the experience that you can read about in almost all bands that have ever played in Belfast will tell you about, staying at the Europa Hotel, which I did.
Most bombed hotel in the world, wasn't it?
It was. And
I stayed there.
My first experience of the Europa was the same as everybody else's. You look out the window and you see British Army coming down with real guns, crouching, looking, you know, patrolling the streets. A bit of an eye opener.
Wasn't there a Rock Goes to College with you too? Was it Queen Elizabeth Hall or something?
Yeah, that was later. That was in the that was January 81.
Went to that. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I was there too. we were probably standing next to each other, Tony. I made my way down to the university, and sure enough, U2 came on, and there was only very few people in the hall as usual, and I watched the band, and my first impression was like, that guy playing the guitar is wearing jeans with biro all over them. I said, that's what we used to do at school when we were about 14. I thought, that's really uncool. And then I thought, that guy playing the bass has got massive great big spectacles on and a great big mop of hair, and that's really uncool. And that drummer, I can't see him because he's behind the singer, but that singer, he's a bit awkward and he's a bit podgy, but he's really earnest, he's really into what he's doing, and there's a few people down the front that seem to be into it. And then they finished their very, very, very short set. And I thought, well, I've come all the way from Ireland. Bob isn't here. Last time I went backstage for Lennox, I got my ear chewed off. I thought, but I better go backstage and say hello. So I went backstage and I'm greeted by Paul McGuinness, who is so excited that I'm there at all. And then I'm introduced to the band, except that only Bono gets a word in edgeways because only Bono could. And the overwhelming impression was of people who were so thrilled that I was there, for whom it meant so much that I should have made that effort. And to be honest, this was the first time that I had a band that I could call my own. This was my band. And this was a band that really wanted me to be working for them and really felt, they didn't feel privileged, but they felt grateful, if you like. And very, very short conversation, because they had to, they were loading the gear in their van as they were speaking to me, and they had to drive back to Dublin because they didn't have the luxury of a hotel. And that was that. So I went back to the Europa Hotel. As I'm walking in the door of the Europa Hotel, as it seemed, Paul McGuinness is at my shoulder. I mean, boy, was that a man working the room. He was all over me like a rash. So excited that I was there. So wanting me to put a tour together for him, which I did, a tour of London. He needed a record deal. And that's what he needed. He needed to come to London, needed some shows in London. I had the first of what would be very, very many experiences with Paul, which I'm sure you, Tony, have experienced. A long night at the bar. In fact, so long that you don't really bother going to bed because it's time to go to the airport and go home the next day. But you are convinced that you've solved all the problems of the world and that you are bosom friends forever and nothing can ever change. And so it was that night that I left with a massive hangover, but convinced that I had my my second band, my first.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
This band being the Photos, but that band had been bequeathed to me by James. But this was my band, U2.
You're listening to Moments That Rock. Let's get back to former agent, first person to discover and promote U2. And he continues the story. Ian Wilson is his name on Moments That Rock.
I got back to London and I booked them 2 weeks worth of club shows with great help from a guy called Martin Horn, who just joined us from Cowbell. And Martin and I, together with an amazing piece of help from Bob Gold, gave you two weeks worth of club dates in London in less than 2 weeks. From the time that I saw you two, it was about mid-November, about November the 16th, I think, if my memory is correct. And their first show was on the 1st of December. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, that's the power of a powerful agency. Because we had Ian Dury, because we had The Clash, because we had the B-52s, Talking Heads, we could pull those kinds of things out of the fire. And the first show that I booked for them, Martin got me. Martin was interested in a band called Dolly Mixture, who were the little girl mod band. We were beginning to be in that era of mod bands like Secret Affair and The Chords and all those bands. So there was a kind of street scene in London for mod coming, spinning off of The Jam, basically. And Dolly Mixture had got themselves a gig at the Moonlight Club, and we put U2 on with them. U2 were, of course, billed as the U2s, and I'm sure it wasn't me that did that. I'm sure it wasn't me that said that, because pretty much every promoter was billing them as U2s. And I learned the following year that Paul and the band were incredibly upset about this. They were not U2s. They were U2. Very, you know, we had to get branding with U2 right very early. But that gig at the Moonlight Club, I remember really well, because Edge turned up with a plaster cast on his hand. And I thought, how's he going to play the guitar? You know? But I was transfixed, because not only did he play the guitar, but he could still play the guitar with a plaster cast on that would have been his plectrum hand. So that was his right hand. Apparently they'd had a bit of a car accident on the drive over, and Edge had injured himself. But I was just so proud of them that night, and I was just so committed that they would be my band. And the huge stroke of luck, which really kind of changed it for U2, was Talking Heads. Talking Heads were playing at the Electric Ballroom two nights. And they'd originally had the Human League opening for them on that tour. The Human League had then basically dropped out, and we'd replaced them with OMD. And this was really a favour that Bob Gold was able to do, because Bob Gold could make a phone call to somebody who was as tough as Roger Eagle to ever get hold of, and a very, very important promoter, a man called John Curd. John Curd was the London street promoter. He was the guy that had done the Roundhouse, and he was doing Sunday nights at the Lyceum by now. And he was also doing the Electric Ballroom in Camden. And Bob put the call into John. John put you two on that show. And that was the beginning of U2 outside of Ireland beginning to feel that they could point at the stars. And I did actually speak indirectly to the singer from OMD. He told me the story of how Adam and he were sitting on the stairs at the side of the stage while Talking Heads were sound checking. And then Tina Weymouth came off and then started chatting. They had like a bass players union meeting. And she was saying how sick she was being on the road. They've been on the road for 8 months and she was really fed up with it. Andy McCluskey and Adam Clayton looked at each other with their jaws open, because I thought they would have given their right arms, left arms and right and left legs to have been on the road for 8 months. I mean, that's all they wanted to do. That's all they could dream of doing. And to be in a position like Talking Heads were at that time was what they could dream of. But there was Tina Weyman saying, well, it's not what it's cracked up to be. I don't know how Adam would answer that question today, whether he would think being the bass player in U2 and being on the road for years at a time is all it's cracked up to be. I'm not sure. That tour was the first thing I did for U2. And from my perspective, it was really exciting. From U2's perspective, it was knife-edge stuff, because they had been let down by Brian Morrison, who was a publisher who later became well known for finding Wham. But Brian Morrison had offered Paul a publishing deal, which was going to finance this trip to London, and then pulled out of it. So that trip to London was financed by the band's parents. And they came to London, ran up a debt, and ran up a very, very little interest from the London A&R community. So I had the experience of seeing how easy it had been for the photos and how almost nearly impossible it had been for U2. And one of the things that U2 did, which I don't think they will have ever done again, is they played at the Hope and Anchor for their third gig, and Edge broke a string. And he couldn't really play as he wanted to play, and they kind of like stopped three quarters of the way through and went off. And I think that's maybe why they didn't get the interest. I think the Hope and Anchor would have been the gig that there would have been the big A&R turnout to, because it was a recognised gig, but it's on a Tuesday night. A&R people go out sort of Monday to Thursday. They party Friday to Sunday. as you will know, it took you two going back to Ireland and the island of Ireland, and it took Bill Stewart, who I believe had been in the British Army once upon a time, who probably knew Belfast and Dublin pretty well, to go over and see you two perform in Ireland and persuade the people at Ireland. Primarily, I think Rob Partridge, I think, was probably the main person he had to persuade, because I think Rob had the ability to persuade Blackwell that they should be signing U2. And they did. Other champions, as you know full well at that time, obviously were Neil Story and Annie Roseberry. But that basically was the extent of it. It was Bill, Annie, Neil and Rob. Blackwell came on board later.
Wonderful stuff from Mr. Ian Wilson, who was U2's first agent and saw them right through the success and everything in the early stages at Wasted Talent. Put them on in London for a few shows. It's very close to me. I do know, like I say, I do know the story, but I was there. It was the reason I went back to Island Records after working with Genesis and Peter Gabriel to work with that band. And I agree, all those people that he mentioned were the only people that were really into him, apart from me, I have to say, who's at the time probably the only person in the promotion department. Because the head of promotion at the time, we won't mention any names, couldn't really see it. But there is actually four separate podcasts devoted to you two on Moments at Rock. If you troll back, there's one with Mr. Dave Robinson, who was there in 1984 when the Unforgettable Fire, Red Rocks and everything exploded, and he was the managing director. We have Neil Story, who Ian Wilson mentioned, who was part of the press department. We have Malcolm Gerry, who basically put together the TV crew that went over from Newcastle to film Red Rocks, which turned into one of the greatest rock films of all time. And we have Mark Radcliffe, who is from BBC Radio 1 in England, and I went to see them at Manchester Polytechnic when they were third on the bill on the 31st of May 1981. And then 4 days later, of course they weren't signed, and then 4 days later I went to see them play in a pub in Manchester to 11 people, and four of those people came with me. But I also have a special programme myself on the podcast, which is an interview I did with Adam and The Edge just before the Unforgettable Fire, and there's an interview with Bono and The Edge. And so go back through, troll through all these wherever you listening to it, and if you are interested in YouTube, there's plenty of information. You've been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides. We will be back next week with another one. Please subscribe, come back for more, because I'm coming back for more.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.